We're talking about lung cancer screening here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lung cancer takes lives. It causes more deaths in a year than all the colon, breast, and prostate cancer deaths combined. And there's debate in the medical community over how to screen for it, specifically when it comes to ordering up this sophisticated type of X-ray imaging called a low-dose CT scan. What do you want to know about your risk for lung cancer and how you should proceed? Have you had a CT scan for lung cancer? Have you had a chest X-ray looking for a tumor? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Jeffrey Caney is a radiology professor and chief of thoracic imaging at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Caney, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So we see, according to this recent study from the CDC, only 4% of people who are eligible for lung cancer screenings are getting them. Why is that number so low?
Well, it's a very complicated thing. First of all, that study that was published looked at data from 2010 to 2015. And lung cancer screening, the big study, the National Lung Screening Trial, wasn't published until 2011. And it wasn't until 2013 that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released their Grade B recommendation, and not until 2015 that Medicare provided a coverage statement for lung cancer screening. So I think the uptake initially was pretty slow while the medical community awaited guidance from the government and recommendations for screening. In the meantime, many professional organizations did put out recommendations that patients be screened. The other issue we run into, I think, is there's still, I think, a lot of lack of knowledge among patients and primary care physicians. Patients may not be aware it's available. Patients may be scared about the test, uncertain what they're going to find. There may be some patients may feel there's a stigma attached to smoking. They don't really want to talk about it. And then some of the primary care physicians may not be aware of how who is eligible for screening. Unlike other screening tests where there's a cutoff for age, it's straightforward, lung cancer screening is a bit more complicated. We have an age range, we have a smoking history range, and for former smokers, they had to have had quit in the past 15 years. So staying on top of who's eligible at each visit is a little bit more complicated.
Right, so there it's a very particular threshold. What is involved with the CT scan and this screening?
So first is required what's called a shared decision-making visit. This is about a 15-minute appointment, usually with a primary care physician, where the patient discusses the test, the risks, the benefits, the alternatives, which are not to be screened. And then at that point, the patient must receive a written order for the exam. Then they would go to a local screening center, and a CT scan is a type of medical imaging test that uses X-rays and sort of in a circular fashion. It creates a cross-sectional image of the chest. At that point, the images would be interpreted by a radiologist and recommendations for further management, whether it's continuing screening. Occasionally, patients have a finding on their CT scan that requires closer monitoring, and then only a very small number would require a more invasive test after that point.
Well, some people have been getting a chest X-ray instead of a CT scan. Can chest X-rays detect lung cancer?
Unfortunately, not. Chest X-rays have not been shown to reduce mortality from lung cancer. We do find lung cancers on chest X-ray, but it's almost always in patients who are symptomatic, coughing up blood, losing weight, having trouble breathing, and it's usually at that point where it's the opportunity for curing the lung cancer is much lower. And so current recommendations based on many decades of research have shown no value in getting chest X-rays to screen for lung cancer.
We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Caney. He's a professor of radiology and chief of thoracic imaging at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in. Have you or someone you know had lung cancer? Are you over 55, a smoker, or someone who gave up smoking recently? What are your questions about your risk for lung cancer and how you should proceed with testing? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Caney, why are the qualifications for the CT scan screening, why are they so strict?
Well, the research that was done, the National Lung Screening Trial, was a study of 55,000 patients, high-risk patients. And based on that study, they studied only the highest-risk patients. They found that age threshold of about 55 to 80 was appropriate. And then they defined heavy smokers of 30 pack years, which is a pack a day for 30 years or two packs a day for 15 years, and that we also, that former smokers had to have quit within 15 years, because we know once you quit smoking, your risk of lung cancer start to go down. And as a matter of fact, smoking cessation is the best, most effective way to reduce risk of lung cancer and the overall health benefits. And just all the requirements from a shared decision-making visit, a written order for a lung cancer screening CT, and depending whether you have private insurance or Medicare or Medicaid, the rules are a little bit different.
Are there high false positives with CT scans, or are they prone to overdiagnosis, finding things that are not threatening?
So a false positive in a lung cancer screen typically means we find a lung nodule or a little spot on a patient's lung. The majority of those nodules are benign, and the majority of those require just additional imaging, either in another year, sometimes shorter period, 6 or 3 months. And only a very small number of them would go on to have a biopsy or other invasive test. So even though they're false positives in the sense that there's an abnormality, the overwhelming majority of them don't require an invasive test. Now, overdiagnosis has been sort of debated a lot in the medical literature, and what that is finding cancers that would not affect a patient's lifespan. And built into our lung cancer screening program are guidelines for management. So although we might find a lung nodule that may be a cancer, using the best data we have, we don't always act on those right away. We may continue to screen the patient or continue to follow the nodule closely rather than jumping right to a biopsy, knowing that it may behave in a very benign manner and may not require aggressive treatment.
Should patients be concerned about radiation exposure at all with a CT scan?
So the radiation from a CT screening CT is approximately that of about 10 chest x-rays, or about a third of the amount of radiation the typical patient would receive just living in the United States over a year. In the age group we're talking about, there's really no solid data showing risks to patients. A lot of it's based on theoretical models, but given the risk of lung cancer and other health risks at that age and with that kind of smoking history, the benefits of screening, I believe, and I think many of my colleagues believe, far outweigh any risk of, or potential risk from radiation.
So if CT scans are a really good defense against lung cancer, outside of stopping smoking, of course, then why aren't they on the same page about it? What's the controversy?
Well, I think there's a lot of stigma attached to it. It's smoking is a modifiable risk factor, and I think primary care physicians and physicians in general are pressed for time during visits and want to focus on things like cholesterol screening and blood pressure and healthy lifestyle and things like that. And smokers may not wish to talk about it. Maybe they quit already and it's not in the mind of the primary care physician anymore. Some people may just not believe in it. They think it's an expensive test relative to $100 blood test or something like that, or they may think, well, the patient smoked, and even unconsciously, people may think it's just not a good use of public health resources because it's something a patient, one might say, inflicted on themselves, even though we don't like to look at it that way.
Dr. Caney, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jeffrey Caney is a professor of radiology and chief of thoracic imaging at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up, it's the latest on vaping. Federal numbers show more people who use e-cigarettes are getting sick, and health officials are warning teens and adults to put down the vape pens. Do you vape? Are you concerned about the potential side effects? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get to that conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the health effects from e-cigarette use here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. E-cigarettes are battery-operated devices that typically heat a flavored nicotine solution into this vapor, which is then inhaled And now federal health officials are reporting that the number of people sickened with a severe lung illness linked to vaping has more than doubled to 450 possible cases in dozens of states, with at least five deaths now. Closer to home here in Wisconsin, health officials, they're saying 34 people have been hospitalized for severe lung disease and damage from vaping. Do you vape? How did you decide what product to use? Are you concerned about potential side effects? How often do you do it? We're at 800-642-1234. Sven Erik Hjort is a toxicologist. His research includes chemicals in vape liquids and their effects on the body. He's an associate professor at Duke University, teaching in the fields of anesthesiology, pharmacology, and cancer biology. Sven Erik, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for inviting me to your show.
Well, the CDC just released this data that the number of people who've gotten sick from vaping is on the rise. What are the health effects of vaping? What do we know?
These cases were first reported in July and August, including in Wisconsin, Illinois, and other Midwestern states. And we now know that similar cases were reported in more than 33 states in the U.S. Effects seen are similar to a pneumonia, to an extreme form of pneumonia, with this cough, shortness of breath, often fever, bloody cough, and other symptoms. Doctors were puzzled since they didn't see any bacteria or an infectious agents, and it took a while to connect this to vaping. So this is why it took a little longer to diagnose these cases and link them to vaping.
Health officials in Wisconsin are urging people to stop vaping. And then we heard Michigan's governor calling for a ban on flavored vaping products. Do leaders have enough evidence to say for certain that vaping is a public health issue?
I also wanted to add the CDC has issued statements on Friday nationwide to stop vaping or not even starting it. Most health officials involved in these cases say is that the majority is caused by vaping of marijuana, THC products, but some patients have not used them. So, their disease may be due to vaping nicotine products that may be legal or also illegal. That's why there is a recommendation for stopping vaping at this point, even by CDC.
So you're at Duke. You're collaborating with researchers at Yale to figure out what is in that vape juice. What are you finding?
We primarily focused on nicotine products. So what's usually in these nicotine products are solvents like propylene glycol or glycerin, nicotine, and flavors. And we have been focusing on flavor chemicals that we knew already 10, 12 years ago can be hazardous if inhaled. And currently none of the flavors in these e-cigarettes is really approved for inhalation. They're used in food products, in cosmetics, but not for inhalation. So we started this research in 2013 being very concerned about the flavors, and we found that the e-cigarette liquids, the liquids that get vaporized, are chemically unstable and form new products that are not declared and that we don't know much about and may be toxic.
And then there was this new research in July focused on Juul liquids. Mm-hmm. And what did you find there?
Yeah, we made similar observations that Juul liquids also contain new chemical products that are generated right after mixing of the flavor in the factory, basically, and that we don't know much about. In terms of their irritancy, we found in cell assays that they can have irritant effects.
We're talking with Sven Erik Hjort. He is a toxicologist who researches chemicals and vape liquids and their health effects on our health. Do you vape? Are you concerned about potential side effects and the health warnings that you see? Do you think we know enough about e-cigarette products? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sven Erik, it appears vaping devices create acetals. What are those? How do they form?
These are the chemicals I just mentioned. So these form through reactions of certain flavors, such as a vanilla flavor or berry flavors with the solvents. And we found them to be stable. The vapors inhale them, and they cause irritation by activating pathways that make us feel like coarse, that induce cough and inflammation.
And some of these acetals are safe. They're safe to eat. They're safe to touch. How do we know about the safety of them when we inhale them in vaping?
There have been no really systematic inhalation toxicology studies on them, and the Flavor Extract Manufacturing Association, the industry association of the manufacturers, has also warned that they cannot vouch for their safety when they are inhaled. But they have been used in foods and skin products for a long time and have been proven safe there.
And some vaping companies are arguing the levels of exposure in your studies are above normal use of a vaping device. How do you respond to that critique?
Vapors, since it's a really uncontrolled market, they inhale extremely varying amounts, and we calculated this based on heavy use, and we observed that the levels that vapors are exposed are getting close to occupational levels of people who work with these in factories or bakeries, and usually the government sets the more general toxic levels much lower as occupational levels. That's why we think there should be a concern and this should be investigated further.
So how often would a person vape if they would be considered high use?
In terms of Juul, we would consider maybe 1 to 2 pods a day. And for heavyweight vapors using these larger models that produce a lot of vapor, it's around like half an ounce of fluid per day or 10 milliliters or something like that.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here about how this technology works. How do vaping products work? You've talked about Juul, and we're looking here also at vape pens. Explain what's happening here.
The current cases, as I mentioned, have been linked to mostly marijuana use. And these vape pens are, in a way, very similar to e-cigarettes. However, the liquid is not the standard nicotine liquid. It's since in a lot of states the use is illegal and not regulated, we don't know which chemicals these illegal vendors put in there. And what was found last week in New York is that the marijuana liquids contain an emulsifier, a vitamin E derivative that is likely the culprit in a majority of the cases. So that's quite different from the nicotine devices. But again, as I said, there are also vapers now in hospital who have not vaped marijuana products.
Are there more chemicals in these products than in traditional cigarettes or cigars, for that matter?
Manufacturers put in less chemicals. It's usually like 5 to 7. But what we observe then is that immediately after mixing, reactions are taking place that could increase the variety of chemicals to potentially hundreds. In cigarette smoke, we know there are several thousand different compounds due to the combustion, the burning. But the number of compounds doesn't say really anything about safety. That's what I wanted to mention.
Oh, so that once those compounds start interacting with each other, there's it really compounds, so to speak. They make more and more.
Yeah, exactly. And then when they are heated and vaped, we also see additional compounds being formed then. So it's possible that there are more than 100 different compounds in the vapor.
And some vaping supporters argue that the temperature of vape liquid makes a difference in the chemicals exposed to the body. What does your research say there?
The chemical reactions we've seen, they occur at room temperature, even without heating. But it's true that if you heat the vape liquid in e-cigarettes, that oxidation can take place and that additional toxic compounds are formed.
We're talking with Duke University toxicologist Sven-Erik Hjort. Parents, have you talked to your kids about vaping? Have they told you about it in school? Do you work in a smoke shop that sells vaping and e-cigarette products? What are you seeing and hearing? What conversations are you having around e-cigarettes? Join in at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And if you're just joining us, we're looking at the health effects of vaping and the heightened concern from health officials straight across the country. A Harvard public health official wrote an editorial that was published Friday in the New England Journal of Medicine. It says, quote, "There is clearly an epidemic that begs for an urgent response." Meanwhile, hundreds of cases of severe lung illness are being reported across the country, including here in Wisconsin. Do you vape? Have you used e-cigarettes to try to curb your traditional cigarette smoking habit? Physicians, what are you seeing here? What do you tell your patients who vape? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Toxicologist and Duke University researcher Sven-Erik Hjort studies chemicals in vaping liquids, and he looks at how vaping affects human health. He stays with us. Sven-Erik, can researchers tell yet how addictive e-cigarettes are? When you compare nicotine addiction from traditional cigarette smoking, is vaping more addictive? Can we tell yet?
What we know, especially related to the Juul epidemic over the last 2 years, is yes, the new forms of nicotine that are used in some of these more recent products like Juul are at least as addictive as nicotine in cigarettes, and potentially even more. The concentrations of nicotine in these devices is very high.
Are you surprised that we're seeing an influx of cases of lung issues, severe lung issues, in people who are vaping?
I'm not. At scientific meetings, even 3 years ago, I was approached by emergency physicians mentioning sporadic cases of vaping-induced asthma and other complications. There are case reports also already filed 3 years ago. Now with millions vaping, I think we see a peak of the tip of the iceberg, unfortunately.
Well, let's take a call on this. Amanda is joining us from Eagle River. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
What's on your mind about vaping?
I'm on the organ transplant list for a kidney and a pancreas, and my boyfriend is currently a cigarette smoker. And we've talked about him quitting because of the risks of cancer after taking the anti-rejection meds, and he brought up vaping, and I was wondering what the risks to a secondhand exposure are of vaping compared to a cigarette smoker.
Amanda, thanks for that question. Sven-Erik, do we know about secondhand risks?
At this point, we know very little. We know that employees in vape shops that are not cleaned or ventilated are exposed to quite high levels of nicotine and other chemicals. However, compared to a home where a smoker is, the exposure is likely lower. But I would recommend using a different product like a nicotine patch or a gum instead of a product that releases nicotine into the air.
Amanda, what about a patch or nicotine gum? Have you talked about that with your partner?
We haven't brought it up. He hasn't. He previously quit about 6 years ago and unfortunately took the habit back up. He's never used a patch or gum before. He's vaped before. So he's kind of the one that brought that up as far as an option.
Amanda, are you concerned about vaping considering the recent health scares out there?
I am, and I'm definitely more concerned considering, you know, my immune system will be basically shot once I have to start taking anti-rejection meds. The risks of cancers go way up after that, and, you know, I've basically told him that I can't be around him unless he quits smoking.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for telling your story. Sven Erik, we've seen many of the patients hospitalized after vaping in their teens or in their 20s, and the symptoms have been shortness of breath, vomiting, fever, and fatigue, as you mentioned. What causes that reaction in the lungs and the rest of the body?
It's a reaction against an inhalation of toxic chemicals that has been described before in elderly patients that aspirate like fatty substances, for example, like certain laxatives, but very sporadically. And there's it's called a lipoid pneumonia, basically, that is the inhalation of fatty substances or aerosols that causes that.
Well, we are going to hear here in a moment from Dr. Janae Khaldun, who is Michigan's public health chief, and she says flavored liquids are a gateway for young users.
For many of them, a flavored e-cigarette is what they use initially.
So what flavors do you come across in your lab, in your testing?
We know especially from our collaborators at Yale who study high school students, that the fruity and candy flavors are very popular, like cherry or creme brulee, mango, and also the minty flavors.
How many flavors are out there, do you know?
They are marketed. There are hundreds or even thousands of different liquids with very creative names. However, they contain like a limited amount of chemicals that are mixed together.
In order to make all of these different flavors, so you find that the chemical makeup in them, even though there are zillions of flavors, that they are all very similar?
Yeah, it's probably 20 to 30 different chemicals that are in the majority of these flavor varieties. Since Juul has such a dominating market share, almost 75%, we focus currently on these exporters. And then they have probably 15 to 20 different flavors in them.
Well, lawmakers here in Wisconsin have interest in banning e-cigarette flavors like bubblegum and cotton candy.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know if the look and the taste of these products has made them more appealing for teens?
Absolutely. Teens like to experiment. They are conditioned to, as children, to associate these flavors with kind of sweetness, nice taste, and a reward. This is really to trigger the reward system in the brain. That's very clear that this is happening.
We're talking with Sven Erik Hjort. He's a toxicologist at Duke University, and we're talking about the dangers of vaping, what we know about it and what we don't. Have you used vape products to curb your traditional cigarette smoking habit? How has that worked? Physicians, what are you seeing here? What do you tell your patients who vape? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sven Erik, what role does menthol products have in this conversation?
We have been studying the actions of menthol since the late 90s in the context of pain research. So menthol can suppress pain, it suppresses cough, and we and others found that it is instrumental in initiating smoking of menthol cigarettes. And we are now extending this to e-cigarettes also.
So some say that menthol actually suppresses cough and basically helps the chemicals work. What I don't understand. What does menthol do?
So menthol has two effects. On the one hand, it smells minty, so that gives you a conditioning impulse when you smell something minty to use the next cigarette. On the other hand, it also has a cooling effect, and this cooling effect in the airways, that suppresses the cough and irritation if you inhale smoke or a vape product.
So do we know who is using vape devices and why they're using them? Where is the market right now as we see it?
The majority of the market, unfortunately, is young adults and adolescents, children. There's also an adult market that is older, that uses more traditional products. But Juul, especially, is used widely by young adults and adolescents. I see at Duke University, a lot of our undergrads use it. My daughter is in high school. A lot of her friends use Juul illegally. So unfortunately, the majority is really younger users.
And some recent conversations around vaping has been focused on whether they are or aren't marketed to minors. What do we know about the marketing efforts?
We know from studies reviewing marketing in 2015, 16, 17, especially from Juul, is that there was a lot of viral marketing on YouTube by influencers targeting young users directly and school children. It's also the advertising shows usually young, adolescent, attractive people in situations like in bars or others that are very attractive, related to partying and other things. Excuse me. So it's very clear that initially these products were marketed to younger users.
Are vaping devices being modified by users in any way? Do we see that going on?
Traditionally, vaping devices, the first ones, could be modified by users. Currently, the Juul products, if you stay within the system, cannot be modified. However, they are now aftermarket illegal pods being produced, imported from China and other places that basically are modifications. And there's a big concern that the company really has lost control of its product, and we now have illegal aftermarket products with unknown chemicals in them being marketed on eBay, on many other illegal platforms that kids are using.
We're looking at this widespread public health scare over vaping and e-cigarette use. An e-cigarette heats a flavored nicotine solution into a vapor, which is inhaled. And Sven-Erik Hjort is a Duke University toxicologist who researches what's in these chemicals. He stays with us. Do you or someone you know use vaping products? Do you think the public misunderstands vaping and e-cigarettes? Do you wonder what chemicals are in e-cigarette fluids? Bring your questions, your situation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the health effects of e-cigarette use and the growing national concern over vaping as hundreds of cases of severe lung disease are being reported across the country. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. E-cigarettes are these battery-operated devices that deliver nicotine, and they might look like a pen. The industry has positioned these devices as a much safer alternative to the lethal habit of traditional smoking. With the recent illnesses and at least 5 deaths, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says people should consider not using e-cigarette products as an investigation is underway. Do you vape? How did you decide what product to use? What do you think about reports of lung illnesses tied to vaping? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Duke University toxicologist Sven-Erik Hjort stays with us as we look at the health and the science and the marketing of this addiction. Sven-Erik, here in Wisconsin, Eau Claire School District has transferred from fines and punishments for students caught vaping to an education approach. What might students or teachers not realize about vaping as they look for proper punishment?
We know from questionnaires that many of the students actually do not know that nicotine is contained in e-cigarettes, sometimes 30 to 40%.
Wow, 30 to 40% of students may not know that nicotine is in these products.
Yeah, especially the younger kids starting it. They hear a lot by their friends that it just tastes good and has all these flavors and it's cool and it's a little bit illegal, so they like using it. But I want to say that especially in the Juul products that a lot of kids use is that the nicotine concentrations are so high. If you use it regularly, you will be addicted within a week or two. So this is an addiction problem at this point. I think punishment is not the right way to go. Confiscation I would still support, but punishing these kids is the wrong way to go.
So you're saying that if these kids who are caught vaping get a suspension, that won't be a deterrent?
These kids are, many of them are heavily addicted, so they will probably continue vaping at home or use other covert ways to do it. We've seen, for example, now vaping devices that look like a smartwatch that my daughter saw in her high school. They are not even look like vape pens, so the industry is providing them new products to continue this activity. So.
Do we see misinformation coming from the industry?
Initially, yes. Now, especially Juul has changed their marketing. But I'm not really sure if kids really go on Juul's website or listen to all this language at all. I'm not confident that they do. FDA has started a campaign that schools can use, but it's again based on education. There's very little information about how these kids can quit, what kind of treatments, what kind of behaviors can help them quitting, and families are left alone.
Well, let's bring in another call now. Jim is joining us from Reedsburg. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a smoker since the age of 16, and, back then, cigarette smoking was the norm. Up until 2 years ago, I smoked cigarettes and I had a lung attack with pneumonia, which turned viral. But I actually took up vaping, e-cigarettes, and enjoyed it kind of more than the regular cigarette smoke. Well, the first thing I noticed after about a month was my physical ailments. Some of them disappeared. My joint aches, my muscle aches, and I don't know if that's attributed to it, but that's one thing I did notice. And now I'm to the point where I don't need to eat e-cigarettes anymore. For some reason, the addiction for nicotine is kind of what you say going away.
Jim, thank you for describing your story. Sven-Erik, it sounds as if vaping helped Jim get off of traditional cigarettes.
I hear that from some users. I think he's doing the right thing, potentially giving up vaping at some point. I just wanted to warn, in recent studies it has been shown that using vaping to quit perpetuates nicotine addiction, especially if you use these high-level nicotine products. And the goal should be to get off nicotine and not inhale any chemicals into your lungs. So that's what I recommend. So if at some point in the near future he can stop inhaling anything, that would be very beneficial, I think, in addition to what he's already done.
Well, let's bring in Rich now in Kenosha. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. I know people don't like to be told what to do, but politicians do have some kind of responsibility in all this, and why is it even allowed, is beyond me. Just as the oxycodone is allowed to be produced, and it shouldn't be.
Rich, it sounds like you see that regulation from lawmakers across the board is lagging behind.
There isn't anything. They don't care about the people at all.
Well, Rich, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call, Sven Erik. We did hear from Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers said he would agree with health officials that chose to encourage people to stop vaping. How dire is the situation? What should state and federal authorities be doing right now?
I think this is a very reasonable effort to at this point issue statements so people would stop vaping. The situation is very dangerous. We see that the regulatory environment is insufficient to protect the public. There have been significant delays in regulation, especially in 2017 by the FDA that postponed serious regulation by 2 years. And this has unfortunately backfired. I like the analogy with the OxyContin, the caller Rich just mentioned. This addiction epidemic we see in young people that needs to be stopped. And we see probably now that the use of the illegal products can cause a lot of injury and death.
We're talking with Sven Erik Jort, who studies chemicals and vape liquids and their effects on health. Sven Erik, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned THC, the element responsible for marijuana's psychological effects, the part that gives you a high. Marijuana is still illegal in many states. Are these THC cartridges regulated in any way?
They are not at all. Especially in the states that have no legal way to use marijuana. There are certain agreements to use certain ingredients, but the products is basically Wild West out there, and we see them mixing these toxic lipids to extract THC or to kind of stretch and dilute these solutions.
So in the Wild West, where are you taking your research into vaping liquids next?
We are looking at toxicological effects now in models. We're also collaborating with medical professionals to look at what happens in vapors. And we continue our work on menthol and similar cooling agents that are added to these liquids.
As you look for colleagues around the country, do you find that research is on par with where it should be on vaping, or do you find that you are one of maybe a handful of people doing this?
The FDA and other federal institutions have funded research over the last 6 years, but it takes really long to even identify patients. We've seen that it took health officials several months to put all the strings together and relate this to vaping. There's a lot of progress in preclinical research on cell systems and animal models, but we just now see studies in humans coming out pointing to lung complications after vaping.
Sven Erik, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Sven Erik Jort is a toxicologist studying chemicals and vape liquids and their effect on health. He's also an associate professor at Duke University who teaches in the fields of anesthesiology, pharmacology, and cancer biology. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.